Next, John Spencer, who is Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Otari Corporation. The title of his presentation is the Otari Digital Archive System. So I'll turn it over to John Spencer.
Good afternoon. My name is, as Gary said, my name is John Spencer, and I am Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Otari. And if you haven't picked up already in the first couple of sentences, I am from the South. And so for those of you who have a problem with the accent, I believe the hotel does provide an interpreter, and perhaps, you know, we can get one up here. And but what I want to talk about today is essentially what the hardware that we have back in the exhibit area, which is the digital archive system. First off, there's a couple of notes that I'd like to bring your attention to. Otari has been in the tape transport business for about 37 years. We probably helped create some of the proprietary formats that have kind of put us in the archival nightmare that we're in, certainly in the recording environment. But the concept behind the digital archive system was primarily one based around ease of operation and also the knowledge that ultimately the migration of archival analog tapes to a digital format is ultimately inevitable. As much as we and I truly love analog tape, in certain parts of the world we're already starting to see domestic production cease. And so it is inevitable, even if you're concurrently making an analog archival copy, I think it's imperative that you do address the need for having at least a digital copy laying around. Nonetheless, you know, compressed, I know that's a dirty word in this room, but compressed digital archive formats are also nice for those of you who have collections that can be web accessed. So, we don't pretend to propose this system for every type of program material. Certainly, if you have a 30 IPS half-inch orchestral recording, we're probably not your best product. We kind of, what I would say we are is more of a middle of the road, kind of your bread and butter, 3 3/4, 7 1/2, you know, spoken word, oral history. Couple of our most recent installations, in fact, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, we were at Washington Navy Yard doing the Sea Services Oral History Project, which is a combination of the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Coast Guard. They've got a 3-year project of oral history archives that they're migrating. And just this morning, we were very happy to see in the fax machine a purchase order coming from Texas Tech. They have a wonderful Vietnam archive down there as well, which is quite extraordinary and growing as we speak. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we do. Also, so you know, we rent the system as well. For those smaller collections where you do not need to purchase the system, we rent it in 30-day chunks so that if you've got 50 or 100 tapes and you'd like to get them migrated over, we can accommodate that for you. For the large collections, literally man or person years can be shaved off of the migration process if you have thousands of tapes. It's amazing when you see the scale of efficiency that we can provide you, you begin to do the math and it's like, wow, you know, I might actually be able to still be alive when the collection has been migrated. We primarily consider this system as a bridge. We don't pretend to be to have that crystal ball that says where the storage business is going in the next 25 years, the next 50 years, or the next 100 years. We have a unique insight in the storage business because we have a whole separate division of our industrial products where we make loaders for essentially every type of media that you can imagine, from mini DV to DLT to LTO to 8mm, you name it, and we've probably built a loader and probably have sold it to one of the media manufacturers. If I can provide any advice, certainly from my perspective, because we are obviously very much involved with recording studios, and my perspective would be when you start looking at a storage format in terms of your digital data, because once it is digital, it is data, you better look to the enterprise IT environment. When I speak of the enterprise environment, I'm speaking of the Fortune 500 companies. As much as we in the recording business like to think that we're on the cutting edge and that we always have the neatest and greatest latest technology, quite frankly, as things move down the road, we are simply, you know, we're the fly on the tail of the cow when it comes to what the manufacturers are going to do in terms of our own personal needs. So I think it's imperative that you take a look at things like LTO, Super DLT, and those things which can provide you a roadmap, a written roadmap, and say, this is where we're going. So enough of that. This will kind of walk you through the criteria for the system and what we've attempted to do, and I'll be happy to answer a few questions after that. There is a demand for digital libraries. They need instant, random program availability. We really don't want a quality loss, certainly if you're in the archival business. We need to have access to the metadata, as it was evidenced yesterday in a number of the presentations. The metadata is the key to searching contextual databases and making them easily navigated. And we consider a full system migration, meaning we want to provide a turnkey system. Also want to do it in a relatively small footprint. We're, as you notice, we're back there on a 6-foot table, and we're pretty much a complete system. There are some issues in an archival analog tape. I'll just run through them quickly. Most of you have experienced or seen or spoken of all of these, be it splice conditions, pack of the pancake, edge wear, the binder, the flutter, dropouts, alignment. Certainly we know about the copy effect. We know different coercivities and flux depending upon the vintage of the tape and the vintage of the machine that was recorded on and where in the world it was recorded on. And we got record levels that vary all over the map. Then we've got tape speeds, track formats, and tape formats. So not only do we've got a mixed bag of media just within the cassette and quarter inch environment. Those are all what we call front end problems. A couple of philosophies. Real-time transfer. It's labor and cost intensive. I think we know that. It's also time intensive. Or we can look at a high-speed transfer, improving the labor and time efficiency. And I would say, I use the term adequate quality here, but I've always said, you know, A, B, anything yourself. And if it's not acceptable to you as an archivist, then you shouldn't be using it. But if it is acceptable, and you should at least take that step, make the comparison, and if it is acceptable, it's probably appropriate for your collection. So, we looked at the front-end problems that I noted. We looked at the high-speed transfer to achieve some efficiencies of scale. And then the audio post-processing side, which is a separate element and not a part of the migration from analog to digital. So our design targets were the following. We wanted to create a high-speed environment for transferring a multi-format analog audio reel-to-reels to digital files. We wanted a simple and dedicated system that does not require an engineer to operate. We think that's one of the biggest benefits of our system, is that there's one button. And it's a big start button, and if you can put a tape on a machine and hit the start button, you've started the process. We, again, as I said earlier, we did not become the arbiter of what your storage format will be, whether it's CDR, whether it's DVD, whether it's DLT, whether it's LTO. We're not going to make that decision for you. And then, obviously, superb sonic characteristics are also part and parcel of any system such as this. The choice. What we've done is we've created we've taken our best tape transport and our best cassette transports, and we've process optimized those for the transfer process. We're also centered around the broadcast wave format because while there's no, again, I think there's a lot more movement in terms of that being a digital archival format that we can all agree upon, at least in terms of metadata management. Then we have user-selectable intermediate storage. For those of you who have taken a look at the system, you'll notice that we use removable hard drives in our digitizing unit. We can also, if you so choose, put MO drives or DVD drives in there, but right now, you know, hard drives are cheap and storage is plentiful. And the files will only reside on those hard drives for an interim period of time. So it's not imperative that you pick a format that will require you to, that's not where your archival copy will come. So we think the hard drive's the best scenario for that. The elements. Multi-format cassette players, multi-format reel-to-reels, and the analog-to-digital conversion unit itself. There's some pictures. Of course, we've actually got the whole thing here, so I probably should have deleted that file. With respect to the tape player, it is a quarter-inch machine. We can handle any of the following formats: full-track mono, half-track mono or stereo, two-track stereo, or four-track mono or stereo. We can also accommodate multiple players simultaneously. If you are using full-track mono, for example, we can actually be running four mono tape transports simultaneously, capturing four different audio programs. And then we have another B-side input of four audio channels. So I can be putting four more additional mono reels on. I can have a total of eight machines running. I'll show you a little bit more of that in just a moment. Then if you're using a quarter track format, again, we can capture the entire, must be my wife, we can capture the entire program material, both the forwards and reverse tracks, in one pass. So again, we'll take a look at the efficiency here in just a minute. In fact, we'll look at it now. You'll notice as I move these across, these are the copy ratios that we can achieve. So at 15 IPS tape, I can achieve a ratio of up to 2x real time. At 7.5, I can make a decision of being either 2x or 4 times real time. And at 3.75, it's noted here as 4x. We also can modify the system so that you can, if you have a large collection of 3.75s and you want to do it at a 2x transfer rate as opposed to 4x, we can accommodate that as well. Sampling rates that we use, depending upon the copy rate, is ultimately what your sample rate for the program file is. I'll get to that a little bit more in depth in a moment. So because we actually use 96K converters on the input side, but we dither those down to a 48K 16-bit file. I certainly do not want to say that 24-bit 96 kilohertz resolution is not optimal. We feel like in the tests that we've done, certainly with the program material that we're speaking of what we're trying to capture, that I'd be hard-pressed for anyone in the room with a spoken oral history to take a 2496 file and a 16-bit 48K file or an analog copy and do a triple blind and be able to tell which is which. You can achieve a pretty fair amount of storage savings also with a 16-bit file. But we do create some efficiencies of scale. If I'm doing four programs simultaneously, a two-track 15 IPS tape, I'm getting a throughput or an efficiency of 8 times real time. If I'm doing two stereo programs, I'm getting 4 times real time efficiency. If I'm using 7.5-inch tape, 7.5 IPS tape, I'm also getting an efficiency of 8x. If I'm doing 4-track mono, doing 4 programs at the same time, I can get up to a 16-to-1 throughput efficiency. And again, that all goes back to when you want to get you've got the law of diminishing returns in something like this. You've got tapes on a shelf. perhaps in a wonderful vault or perhaps not in a wonderful vault. You've got a limited amount of personnel, so you're at a trade-off. You know, we can either real-time everything and watch over time as the elements degrade, or we can speed the process up and make the collection more available to more people more quickly. This is a typical transfer setup. Here we've got, as I spoke of earlier, we've got four full-track mono machines operating on the A side. We've got four full-track mono machines operating on the B side. So a single person could be putting tapes on these machines and be literally just stacking up the digitizing work to be laid back to the you choose in terms of a digital storage media. We created a number of library functions for the transport. Reference flux switching, reverse play monitoring, as well as auto rewind. We have what we call an online mode. Basically, the main unit takes over the transport controls of the MTR-15 transport that we use. So if someone inadvertently tries to step up and touch the transport controls, they're locked out of that, and they can't touch it once the recording process is started, and they can't stop it either. Got an adjustable library wind speed, so when the tape is completed digitizing, we roll it back at 60 IPS and get a nice what we call a library pack, as I'm sure you're aware of, no edge damage. We want to put that tape back on the shelf in the best possible manner that we can. We also have a couple of options that we can put on transports per your request. We can do pinhole detection, we can do leader tape detection, we can do oxide side detection, and we can also do a cleaning station as well. I will, when I say a cleaning station, I don't, again, I want to underscore that I do not advise, nor do I say that if you've got a large collection of tapes that have sticky shed syndrome, my cleaning station is not going to eliminate that problem. But it will, like we use a SIC wipe, and that's what's typically used in a loading process of virgin tape. And it's a real unobtrusive cleaning system that will allow you to pull the tape through and put it back on the shelf in a better condition than it was initially. And then we don't have a record head on the machine, so the machines come standard with two different playback heads. So it'll either be a mono and a half track head, or it'll be a half track head and a quarter track head. And then again, the speeds are going to vary, playback equalizations are going to vary. You simply tell us what it is you want, and we'll put it together. For the cassette player, we have a couple of different models. We've got mono cassette and or four-channel cassettes. We can accommodate either half-speed, normal speed, or double-speed cassettes, and we can again do those at up to a 4x real-time transfer. They can also, you can also have them simultaneously taking two tapes at a time, taking all the data off, then switching to another machine, two tapes at a time. You're starting to see a bit of a theme here. The theme here is throughput. I mean, the bottom line is trying to get the collection through the digitization process as quickly as possible. So, special functions of our cassette players: four-track recording, alternating or simultaneous play. Again, a 2x or a 4x transfer. Auto detection of a chrome or a normal cassette shell. Another online mode where once you hit a switch, the machine comes online, you can't touch the transport controls and stop the process. And then we have standard reference level and also gain makeup controls on both the open reel and the cassette machine. So if there's not enough level off the tape, you can right at the point of playback give it some additional gain. As I said, we've got both two-track and four-track versions. Now the digitizing unit. There's the top red is where we have our A or B input selection, as well as the auto selection, which allows you to do an automated transfer from A to B. The next button is where we do our track format selections. The next one's where we do our copy speed selection. and then we do a sampling rate selection. As I spoke earlier, there's not much on this front panel. You've got four bar graph meters. You've also got some trim pots there. If there's additional gain that needs to be made up, we like to try to make it up on the playback machine side first. But if you need to adjust the level on the analog to digital converter, you can do that as well. And then we've got a couple of removable drives. And those removable drives have LED bar graphs. I refer to them as gas gauges above each drive. And each LED represents approximately 10% of drive space. So again, without having a copious amount of knowledge about how many bytes or bits or what's left on the drive, anyone, an intern or an assistant, can take a look at the gas gauge and determine how much space is left on that drive. Once you approach a hard drive getting full, you merely hit the button above the other drive and that drive becomes online and the other one's offline. You unlock the offline drive, pull it out, and then put in another one and you're ready to go. And then there is an LCD display on the front, so if you want to do some titling of the files that you're digitizing at that point in time, you can just simply plug in a normal QWERTY keyboard and type in the work in progress names that you want for those particular files. And then my favorite two buttons, start and cancel, which I think is rather ubiquitous in terms of what I see a lot of times people attempt to do when they've got a large collection is go buy two or three machines off of eBay, which I love eBay. I bought and sold. I think it's great. But they'll be of varying conditions, and then we'll buy a sound card, and then we'll buy an audio editing program, and we're off to the races. I know that certainly a lot of the people that I interact with, you know, some of that's a little bit intimidating. Trying to put it all together is not always easy. Certainly we have PC conflicts and things that also kind of bog us down in terms of the system itself, in terms of it being able to operate on a regular basis. We feel like our system is very robust. It'll work 24-hour days. We can work three shifts if you need us to. Rear panel, just again, as I spoke of, we've got four XLR inputs on the A side, four XLR inputs on the B side, remote control panels for the transports, SCSI as well. So if you want to hang this on to another SCSI interface to a PC, you can. And the power cord. This is essentially a signal flow of what we do. I mean, it's pretty rudimentary. We have our analog input side, analog to digital conversion. This is where we have a RAM buffer where we're able to store the data and sample it before we write it to the drive. I just skipped right past that. And the remote control ports. Audio performance, that's what a lot of people want to know. What's the system capable of doing? We use 24-bit crystal converters, have a dynamic range of approximately 120 dB. Our sampling frequency, again, the master sampling frequency is either 96K or 88.2 if you have selected 44.1 as your final digitizing file format size. There's our frequency response. At 2X, it's 20 to 20 kilohertz flat, ruler flat, and at 4X, it's 20 hertz to 10 kilohertz. I'll also say that we can also provide you comprehensive charts, graphs, and frequency response plots of our analog machines at a higher speed mode, because, you know, obviously you've got to take the playback equalization and shift it. What we'll do then is we'll take a 24-bit input signal, we'll dither it down to a 16-bit file, still yielding a dynamic range of better than 90 dB. Signal noise and crosstalk also exemplary as well. We have, as I said earlier, a variety of different media options. Typically those media options are used in other parts of the world, like Asia, where there is a big MO, has a very big footprint in Asia and has virtually no footprint here in the United States. We can do a number of things like automatically detect the input and put a blank amount of space before the beginning of the file. We can predetermine that before we start the digitization process. We also, on the fly, can take the reverse tracks and flip them so that when you are monitoring off of the analog to digital converter system, you hear it in real time and in the proper time axis. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we can do a file name right at the point of digitization. And then we capture another separate file, which is the peak audio data, so that when you are going in a post-processing environment and you're going to either do some, because you know the purest archival perspective is we don't do any processing whatsoever, but for certain uses of the material, you may wish to do some level normalization, some noise reduction, and with those files, this peak data header information allows most of the systems to more quickly accomplish the level normalization process without as much waiting for the file to be prepared. We, as I mentioned, we're showing back there one of our just a CPU. We have a version of Cool Edit Pro on there. We don't really care if you're doing post-processing what system you use, because most every post-processing system out there will open up a broadcast WAV file or a WAV file. I think what's most important is that it's if you pick and choose your own, pick one that you're comfortable with, pick one that your peers and your colleagues have used and say that it works, and pick one that'll give you the ability to do the save the files as broadcast WAV files. If you do those things, then ultimately you won't be redoubling your efforts several years down the road. So in summary, we want to do high-speed data transfer in a simple and easy manner, automate the system as much as possible. We want to be flexible in terms of the media choices. We like to cut your labor and time costs as much as possible, thereby saving you time. We also believe that we yield excellent audio performance in that particular environment. After all, we do have 37 years of experience in high-speed tape duplication. So with that in mind, be happy to answer some questions. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
In the high-speed transfer process, do your machines make any accommodation for material that might have a noise reduction system installed on it?
We do not. I mean, we can actually custom build a filter that can mimic the actual roll-off of the particular noise reduction system, if that is the type that you were speaking of. DBX type noise reduction, not so easy to do. So unfortunately, those types of DBX encoded tapes or any type of noise reduction system out there that uses a compression and an expansion scheme, it's not a good candidate for a high-speed transfer.
Yes, sir. Playback and a oversampling and then playback at the lower sample rate to do the sample rate kind of conversion and
slow down
the audio.
That is correct.
And the audio quality of that is satisfactory?
We have been in a number of, shall we say, shootouts all over the world, and we continue to deliver systems in most of those situations where we do a shootout. So I think that for the most part, the evidence speaks for itself in that regard. As I said in the initial my initial comments, I certainly don't propose that we are the end-all be-all for all archival transfer to digital. However, we found more often than not the perceived thought that this is going to be of subpar quality doesn't bear itself out in a critical listening environment. I think sometimes we get a little bit over-intimidated with being a spec-driven world, and we as manufacturers, I think, fuel the spec-driven world. But I think, the best measuring test you've got is your ear. Gary? And then Steve?
Should you want to, your system will work in
It will with some modifications. The standard machines will not. We can. Again, we're pretty flexible in that we can.
What I mean, too, is if you want to play a tape in real time on your machine, can you put your Dolby A or DBX between your machine and the D and the A to D converter?
No, you can't. No, you can't do it. You would have to do a tape-to-tape transfer and then bounce it over. Steve? That is correct.
And I'm sure you can explain whether that's happening or not. And the other is dealing with mass production of micro cassettes and mini cassettes. You seem to be working primarily with the regular Philips cassettes.
That is true. First, let me speak to the azimuth issue. And we do not do real-time azimuth correction. What we've done is make the transport very open to a tweaker, shall we say. And then with respect to the microcassette question, I have certainly seen my share of microcassettes in collections, and I can tell you that we've taken a look at trying to come up with a type of transport to accommodate that. It's not so easy to find certain components with respect to that, and also our thought process on the microcassette is we're not so sure that it lends itself to a higher speed due to the
it's
brittle and it's thin. And so that's why we've kind of steered away from that. Does that help? Yes, sir.
So it is feasible for real-time transfers?
Anything is feasible.
And results in the same sound.
That is correct. Yes, sir. One should never let money get in the way of a good collection.
So you're distributing them for free, then?
It's been a good afternoon. We're not cheap, but we're not over the top expensive either. The Open Reel machine's about $12,000. The digitizing box is in the $16,000, $17,000 range. The cassette is about $7,000. It ends up being between $27,000 to $35,000 for a complete system. One of the things that we do every time we sell a system, we fly in our technicians, we do the installation, we do the training, we stay for 2 or 3 days. We try to make sure that the people that are in place at the facility get a good taste of what it is we do, so that when we leave, the process can pretty well get underway.
Is it a complicated learning curve?
Not with that one big start button. It's really not. I mean, we can start pointing at that right from day one, and it starts to sink in pretty quickly. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that to my attention, because no, they're not. And as I mentioned, we do rent the system in 30-day chunks. The rental cost is somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000 per 30 days, and that does two things. That also provides, we also provide a technician on site, and if you decide you need it for another 30-day chunk, the price goes down. If you need it for another 30-day chunk, the price goes down again. Also, 85% of the rental price can be applied to the purchase. Once you get about 90 days into it with me, you might as well buy it. But we'll, for up to a year, we'll give you that credit of that rental fee towards the purchase. I mean, you know, everyone fights the budget game and the budget cycle and the grant proposal cycle, and so we're acutely cognizant that it's not something that every collection can go do. What we've tried to do is make it accommodate the financial environment as much as we can. Any more? Yes, Gary?
Yeah, you mentioned because there's no record head, you've got space for an extra play head.
Yes,
there's
sir.
No erase head either. Can you put a third one in there?
Well, we could, but instead, if you take a look at the system, you'll see that there's a pretty fair amount of spacing on the heads themselves. So. We probably could, but you probably wouldn't want me to quote you the price on that. Any more? Oh, yes, sir.
So for content metadata,
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, some of you may be familiar with some of the what they call more automated systems that do real-time error flagging. You know, there's a couple of schools of thought on that. I mean, sometimes in a recording, if there's a, you know, a thump or a hum or a buzz, you know, I mean, that could be flagged as an error. And I think that's left to debate whether or not in an archival process, whether or not that is an error. And so we just didn't go down that road of automated error, you know, creating a file list of errors, because we didn't feel like that, quite frankly, that we were skilled enough to drop that on top of every potential situation we were in. Any more? Well, again, it's been a pleasure the last couple of days. Thank you for your time, and if we can answer any additional questions, please let us know.